you go to a music venue anywhere, maybe people take it for granted. I don't anymore. I've been through like some really weird situations, not Great White Fire or anything like that, but like I've been in clubs where it's not safe. It's not okay. And when we went through about 3 or 4 years ago, there were all those shootings in the Bataclan in Paris and the UK. We started wanding people. And some people were like, ooh, it's a little weird. I'm like, no, we're trying to keep you safe. Douchey and weird, but we have to do it. Like, so we're gonna do everything in our power. We've discussed it. Our operations guys are so great. They're coming up with plans. We still don't know what we can do upstairs in the big room. The small room's gonna slowly kind of probably open. We'll see, I don't know.
This time on the Plutopia News Network, we offer a rebroadcast of our Facebook Live session with Jack McFadden, senior talent buyer at ACL Live, Austin's state-of-the-art concert venue. We talk about music and the challenges faced by venues like ACL Live in the age of COVID-19. We also talk about rock and roll. Live from Austin, Texas, it's the Plutopia News Network featuring the Not Ready for Cable News players, Maggie Duvall, Susie Sheeler, some guy named Scoop Sweeney, and John Lebkowski. Our guest tonight is Jack McFadden, senior talent buyer for ACL Live, Austin's state-of-the-art live music venue. And now, our designated adult for the evening, the Big Lebkowski.
Wait, you're designating me the adult?
A snappy intro.
Well, here we are again. So, Jack, how are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
So, Jack, we're glad to have you here with us, and we want to talk to you about music.
Ask me anything.
Talking Heads, by the way, we just quoted, what was it? Same As It Ever Was, Same As That Ever Was, and they are actually currently trending right now. Tell me a good David Byrne story. Will you do that?
Why are the Talking Heads trending?
I don't know. They just are.
I have a good one.
It's something about who are the top. Okay. It's something about who are the greatest bands ever, and the Talking Heads seems to be the one that's going across. Everybody is saying that's one of their favorites. So please tell me a really cool Talking Heads story, Jack.
Best American bands. I think that you're right. So I have a good story. One day it was one of my first record company jobs, and I was up at my desk trying to be productive, but I was 22, so that wasn't really an option. And my little brother came up from college and came to visit me. And like he is, he's always like really early. You know, he's like, came in at like 3 o'clock, and I'm like, dude, I'm not gonna be able to see you till like 6. He goes, no problem. Well, I'm going to go down to CBGB and wait for you. And I said, okay, you know, that's cool. You can do whatever. And he wasn't even legal, but my brother seems to get a pass wherever he goes. And he walked into CB's at like 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and there were 13 people in there. He just kind of walked in, and it's David Byrne and like 5 people in the band and like 5 people watching him. They were there to do like a quick hour set. And I rushed down to get down there, and I didn't get there in time, but it was like, I know, that's what I miss about New York the most, is that stuff happened all the time. There was always music around us, but like, you know, my uncle was in bands and stuff like that, but the discovery came really early. Like I was 3 or 4 years old, and I found a bunch of 45s, and then I begged my parents to get like a close and play, and it's never, ever stopped. And so I found myself like high school, like senior year of high school, I started realizing I could just go to the city every time I want. It's right there. And I started hanging out, and I started working at a record store, and then I became a college rep for Capitol Records, even though I wasn't in college. And I ended up having some low level record company jobs, like late 80s, early 90s. And it was so eye opening. It was amazing. That's kind of where I got my start. I helped a band get signed to one of the labels, and then my phone, you know, I was just a young kid. So it was a time where the record companies employed people, and it was, you know, very fun.
Sounds similar to Scoop's background, some of the stuff Scoop used to do.
Yeah, I think you got into the business at exactly the right time, because that's just at the beginning of the change from all the hair bands and weird bands of the 80s into what became, you know, the alt-rock grunge stuff of the 90s. And, you know, it was a lot of exciting stuff going on, a lot of independent labels popping up as well.
Right. Mm-hmm. It was a hard time to work at a major label when you're that young and you know that there's so much cool stuff out there, but you have to deal with like Natalie Cole and the Red Hot Chili Peppers. Like, it was just a weird time to be at that label. And I just remember, I was like, they had a word for it, EMI, every mistake imaginable. And I was just like,
yes.
Why am I here? Like, why am I, I'm 22 years old. What am I learning? And I was learning everything. I was learning what not to do.
Yeah. Those are good lessons though, right?
Fascinating.
Yeah.
Life before I went to the Record Cemetery of America after that. That was
Yeah, life with the major labels at that time was very strange, because I was at, in the 80s, I was managing a hard rock band. We recorded for at Atlantic and A&M, and just totally bizarre people that you had to deal with that had no idea what they were doing and didn't really care what you were doing, as long as they got, you know, their paycheck, I guess.
So, yeah, I mean, at least they, you know, they had money, and that was something. But yeah, you learn a lot about what you want to accomplish when you're surrounded by it. You're like, why are you failing upwards? What are you doing? Why do you care about music? And if you care truly about music that passionately, there's a job in the music business for you, probably just not at EMI Records in 1989, right?
Who are some of the bands that you really enjoyed hanging out with when you were in that phase?
I mean, none of the bands that ended up signing with our label, because they were smart. They were really smart. Like, I lived in Chicago. Okay, so when I left EMI in 91, 92, I went to Chicago for 5 years. And in Chicago, 92 to 97 was absolutely amazing. Like, I have friends now for life. We all went through the craziest time. Every single band, it's never happened to Austin like that, where like one band gets signed, then two bands get signed, then 16 bands are getting, everyone's just getting big deals. And you're all sort of at the, even, you know, you'd have like Liz Phair and Smashing Pumpkins and Material Issue and all these bands hanging out, and none of them really had anything to do with each other. Like, they didn't even make sense on a mixtape, but you would see them all hanging out in the bars just talking about their experiences, you know? Wow. Like, absolutely obscene, weird, crazy stuff. So it bonded a lot of those bands, and I love the bands that came out of Chicago, 92 to 97. It really made me.
Chicago has that whole, it has an Austin feel to it, where, you know, there's a lot of camaraderie, I think, among musicians specifically. It's what I experienced when I was there. I'm not in a band, but I did go to see a lot of shows. And so.
Yeah, there's not a lot of working musicians like in Austin, but I think they're sister cities. I remember when Poi Dog Pondering moved up there. And I felt like, oh my gosh, like, you're from Austin. You know what I mean? It was like this whole posse from Austin had just planted themselves in Chicago.
Yeah.
It was so wonderful.
Did you run like some kind of like establishment there in New York at some point?
Oh, yeah. Well, so when I got out of the music business and I realized there was no more record company, like by the late 90s, I was turning 30 and I was like, record companies aren't a thing anymore. This is kind of weird. I had a little indie label of my own that I had fun with. I was hoping maybe I would, like, you know, win the jackpot, but just really never happened. And so I met my wife, and I had an opportunity to start a bar and a music venue in Park Slope in 2006. And I don't know why I didn't do that 20 years before, because like the only money, everyone wants to have a beer in bad times and good times. People like to go out to a bar and drink and see music, right? But no one wants to spend $15.99 for my weird, crazy taste in music. Like, it's just not, that's not really what it's going to be. So it was just like a runaway success from the first day. Union Hall in Park Slope and the Bell House.
The Bell House.
We modeled the Bell House after the old Antones on 5th and Lavaca. Like, I remember walking into the old Antones and realizing, wait, you could be like in everything in New York is like this, right? It's like long hallway.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I walked
shotgun
in the old
check.
And you were so close to the stage. I mean, it was weird to get to the bathrooms was weird, but the idea of being only this far away from the stage and sort of like a small semicircle was very appealing. So when we built the Bell House, that's kind of what our model was like.
That's a great way to do it. We had a very weird venue in the Bay Area, the Circle Star Theater. It was a circular stage that rotated as the band played. Yeah, that was a little extreme. I went to a show there. I think it was Albert King was playing, and he was having to have his guys go out and get air sickness pills because the rotation of the stage was just killing him. But yeah, that's extreme to the other end. But I agree with you about the long dark corridor of music.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you don't have a choice, but also a lot of, I mean, I've been to a million music venues that weren't designed by music people. They were designed by people with money. You're like, hey, we put bands in here. And it's like, and look, I love Austin to death, but it's the same. We could put bands in here. Like, that's why I love ACL Live. Like, I walked in, I was like, this is a incredible experience. Like, this is Mercedes, and there's 2,500 people. I'm a club kid. I like to be up close. So I was like, to be operating from that kind of confidence behind you and knowing you can do anything is just great.
Yeah. Did you ever attend any of the ACL before it moved to Moody?
No. My first South By was 92. I don't know if you remember Louis J. Myers. He was one of the founders and such a great dude.
Yeah.
And he picked me up from the old airport, and I was like 23, 24, but I was working for a record company, and I was like, oh my God, Austin, this is insane. But same experience where like nothing really left 6th Street. Like, where am I supposed to go? Like, we went up to Threadgill's, and I was like, where are we? We're in the boonies.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's true. Yeah, it was way North Austin. But before, it was on campus, and it was first come, first serve.
Right.
So,
people.
Yeah. And
my wife she went to UT and she worked there. She worked at the station.
I was a volunteer as well. And they get you 2 free Lone Stars. Wow. I mean, what?
I know.
What? It was so fun. It's still great and they deserve the upgrade. I just wish it was still, honestly, I wish it was still accessible to first come, first serve kids, you know, because a lot of us can't afford those prices, and we kind of helped make that a thing.
No, I agree. I mean, the tapings, they don't sell tickets to, but you're right. It's gotten very heavy into donors and stuff. Mm-hmm. And they do have lines out the door, you know, if you come early.
You can buy them online too, though. And so.
What? No, you can't. You cannot buy tickets online for any tapings.
Oh, for tapings. Right.
But there's only 18 tapings a year. I mean, we have to keep those tapings. I don't know how many did they in the small room, but it was probably about the same amount, right? 20 tapings a year, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I mean, we can't be in business for, you know, we have to put 125 other concerts, and that's what I do. Like, I don't do the tapings. Terry is amazing.
Yeah. But
we have to figure out how to make that place survive. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we cast a wide net.
And how's it doing right now since everything's been shut down?
It's been, you know, it's been weird, but our owners are incredible, and they've inspired us to do, like, you know, think outside the box. We're shifting, you know, we're working. It's a good exercise. Just keep working. As long as there's agents, as long as there's bands, and as long as the dialogue is or keep going, you have to kind of do that. You can't just give up. I think the first 2 weeks we were all shell-shocked, like, I don't even know what to do.
Oh, yeah. Right.
And we were like, no, we need to start moving this calendar so that we don't get caught, like, when the time comes, whenever that is. We're operating on a 48 to 72 hour schedule right now, but let's keep pushing it. And if we have to delay it again, we're fine. But, you know, we've been keeping really busy with the streaming. And like I said, our owners are incredible people. Like, they put their money where their mouth is and they expect great things from us. And, you know, we're happy to do it.
That sounds incredibly complex.
Do you have people paying for live streams?
Are you able to charge money for free right now? Okay. We're doing them free with a tip jar. Like, Hayes Carl did Friday night. from his house. It was great. We're just kind of dipping our toe in to see. It'll probably be some sort of revenue generator for us in 2021. But right now we're not interested in making any money for our end right now. You know, like immediately.
Yeah.
Make any
sense. And I was wondering if there's a possibility of doing, I was thinking about this with a lot of theater friends as well, and musicals and all that stuff. Maybe is there a possibility of a hybrid between, maybe there's those people that will pay the big bucks to sit, six seats apart from one another in the venue itself, and then other people could pay to watch the show online. Is that maybe a possibility?
We've spent the last 8 weeks talking out every possibility. Yeah. Again, though, to your point, it's not really in the spirit of Austin to start charging people $1,000 a seat.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, we've already done crazy things that people are like, what the hell is AC Alive charging $500 to see Sting? Well, yeah. Sting needs to get paid. It's not up to us. Right. Like, he cost $1 million. And so we have to figure out how to make it. I wish it was free.
Yeah. Jack, you mentioned juggling the schedule. That strikes me as being really insane because I've worked for a lot of promoters in California and had to deal with the various agencies and booking people. And the idea of having to do that sounds like it must be pretty strange.
Yep. It's just completely bizarre and unknown. And the hardest things right now are we've had sold out shows forever. You know, we've already pushed Steely Dan twice. And now if you push it into a zone where we don't know when we can come back at full, mm-hmm. full capacity, it's hard to think about right now. No, there's no, it's a patchwork plan. There's no leader here. There's nobody going, everything's fine on June 1. Like, that's not real.
Yeah.
So we're just working with the bands, with the agents. We're trying to find the open dates. A lot of the bigger, the bigger the act, the further away it's going to go. It's going to go like 2021, safer zone. But it's a lot, man. I'll tell you that it's a lot.
Have you thought about how to do social distancing in a concert?
Yeah, well, I haven't, but we have a great team. When you go to a music venue anywhere, maybe people take it for granted. I don't anymore. I've been through like some really weird situations, not Great White Fire or anything like that, but like I've been in clubs where it's not safe. It's not okay. And when we went through about 3 or 4 years ago, there were all those shootings in the Bataclan in Paris. And the UK, we started wanding people. And some people were like, ooh, that's a little weird. I'm like, no, we're trying to keep you safe. Douchey and weird, but we have to do it. Like, so we're going to do everything in our power. We've discussed it. Our operations guys are so great. They're coming up with plans. We still don't know what we can do upstairs in the big room. The small room's going to slowly kind of probably open. We'll see. I don't know.
Yeah, security for any kind of large event these days is a lot more complex than it once was. We used to basically eyeball the crowds coming into concerts and check anybody that was carrying something really strange. But now you pretty much have to do a full cavity search with these people.
Yeah, I mean, in Texas, I'm not used to this. You know, I've been here 10 years and I'm like, wow, you have to make sure, keep all your customers safe. And that's what we're talking about, is the confidence that customers would have eventually to go to a show, right?
Yeah.
What does it take?
Right.
What does it take?
Well, he according to AG Paxton, just go on and let's see what happens. Everybody should just get together and we'll find out what happens. Herd mentality, right? Isn't that what we're supposed to do?
Herd immunity.
Get in the same
herd
room.
Mentality.
Herd mentality.
Yeah, there's herd a lot mentality. Of that.
That's big time. Yeah, sheep herd. But I mean, nobody, my doctor was saying today, there's nobody knows. Nobody knows what's going to happen. Like there's just no, I can't imagine being a small business right now. I can't imagine being ACL, my God, this is what happens to this town. If we don't come back from this with our music and our restaurants, what happens? That's who we are.
We will. We will. It's going to come down to how much shit can we eat for as long as we can, and what's your situation? How do you know, we do really well downtown. I don't think we're do well enough to like sit there for a year doing nothing, but that's what it's going to come down to, you know?
What can Austinites do to help our music scene stay strong and come back?
You know, I think we're all working on that. I think that, there's so many, like I said, there's so many working musicians in this town. It was something that I wasn't really prepared for 10 years ago. Austin doesn't know, but that doesn't happen in New York City. It doesn't happen in a lot of places where, you know, you're in five different bands and you made $1,000 this week, like as the bass player of just something. You know what I mean? Like it's incredible how many working musicians there are. And even if they have other jobs, that's where it's probably going to hurt the most. Right.
Right. So
it's just a matter of like, that's why you have Ham. That's why you have all these Sims. You have organizations that are actually looking out for working musicians.
And there's a lot of musicians doing the virtual like streaming events now, but one of the downsides of that is that generally it's just like one person at a time, maybe two, you know, who are playing together. Don't really have bands playing.
Well, I'm also thinking this is uncovering a problem that was already there before COVID hit. And I was just thinking about like how you said that this doesn't happen in New York or whatever. And I'm thinking about a lot of the complaints I was hearing from people before. It's like, well, I'd like to go see these bands, but oh my God, I don't want to go downtown, right? Because of the parking or whatever. And like, whereas if you lived in the Bay Area or Chicago or New York, most people are like, hey, I'll hop on the subway and I'll do the thing or whatever. So maybe there's a little bit of that in all this too. And maybe,
I think it has a lot to do with it.
Yeah. And because it's just the fatigue people feel, I think, you know, with it's so amazing seeing the road so clear. But I didn't get here till 2005, but even then it felt like, hey, it was easy enough to zip around, right? And I'd want to go here and I'd want to go there and check out this and go see that. And now it's like, no,
exactly.
You know, and so it's interesting, like how much of that will come up in the conversations.
Yeah, the presence of mass transit in the Bay Area pretty much kept the downtown San Francisco music scene alive, because there's no place to park in San Francisco, but it didn't matter because you had the BART trains, you had the buses, and they ran all the time. I used to do shows at the clubs, you know, in North Beach, and I just grabbed my Anvil briefcase and get on the BART train. I didn't have to go park. I just go walk over from the station to the club.
I remember times where you might go see something at Berkeley Square and then you'd hop on BART and go over the Paradise Lounge or the DNA Lounge or whatever, and you know, it was just movement and easy and all that. So it'll be interesting to see what happens here. And also, I mean, there was already complaints from a lot of people that there was just so much infill from the, you know, development interests and you know, tech interests, and not that anything was necessarily wrong or right. I'm not going black and white here, but it's just, you know, what are our priorities? So I'll be really intrigued to see, you know, what ACL, what the city, what other entities do. You know, this is kind of really fascinating to me to think of how we're going to problem solve.
I'll tell you my biggest disappointment, because when I first moved here, I realized what I was up against. I know Austin was like a lot of free events. All ages, like people don't understand it either. In New York, we'd have to fight to get anybody under 21 into a show. It was a big deal. It's too much liability. It's a whole city that is based on music and taking your kids and going to these events. For me, my biggest thing, and I don't speak for ACL Live, I swear to God, this is me. Sixth Street. If anything good comes of this and half of those shot bars go out and replace them with 9 Continental Clubs and 9 Don Bucos. And I mean, that's like Nashville has that, right? And Nashville has some crappy places, the Kid Rock, whatever, but they also have like Robert's Western World, and it's a strip, and it's very touristy, and people walk up and down it with their families, and you could duck into a place and see a show. And I always hoped for that, for Sixth Street, considering that was sort of like the beginning of South By. Like, people thought they were in downtown. And I've been here now 10 years, and I never go there. I would go to a show at the Parish once a year if I had to. Like, where's Steamboat? Where's all those places that I went to? Like, that was a cool thing.
Yeah.
So that would be my thing, is that maybe half of those like really weak shot bar places get taken out. The culture, real culture on Sixth Street.
Yeah,
let me think about the old Soap Creek Saloon where you had to drive out into the country, you know, kind of drive through the mud to get to the venue.
Yeah.
And it was just great. It was fabulous. But nobody was, I mean, back then there wasn't much happening on Sixth Street anyway.
Yeah,
nobody was going there. You had Armadillo was kind of close to downtown. And then you had Soap Creek, which was way out. And things were just kind of spread out.
But I've been hearing, too, speaking of Nashville, a number of musicians are moving to Nashville and Memphis because it feels more, you know, like what they're looking for, exactly the vibe you're talking about. I'm like,
Dale Watson just moved to Memphis.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, warning, I was danger, just about warning. To say that. Yeah. I love to go watch Chicken Shit Bingo with Dale. And I used to live right next to the club. And it was just heartbreaking when I heard he was leaving town. He still comes back and does the shows. But yeah. It's not the same.
We did that live stream with Hayes Carl on Friday, and I had to remind myself, oh my God, he's living in Nashville right now. Like, my outreach on the streams has been try to keep it sort of Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was like, oh my God, he is Texas. Come on. I mean, he lived in Austin and Houston forever. Beaumont. But I mean, you know, I'm like, oh my God, like call Alejandro Escovedo right now. He's not here. No one lives in Austin, and I hate that.
I know.
Because like you said, there's not a lot of deep, you know, there's not a lot of deep, like, on the people on the bench here that could, you know, you could call and be like, okay.
Actually, right, mentioning Beaumont makes me think about Kev Russell, who's definitely still here in town.
Oh, yeah.
And he's been doing streamings on Saturday night. In fact, I should plug that right here on Facebook. He's been doing some kind of amazing live streams, and it's just him and his set of guitars. You know, if musicians can make money doing those live streams, that's great, but I have a feeling that they can't. So somehow we got to get the live thing back. And I think the duration of COVID is unpredictable. So who knows what we're going to do, you know?
Well, to address the elephant in the room when it comes to the musicians coming or going, the economy, well, not so much the economy, the cost of living in Austin has changed dramatically. And I saw the same thing happen in the Bay Area, because there used to be a real hotbed of all sorts of working musicians, but they all moved because they just couldn't afford it. I mean, the rents for a crummy one-bedroom apartment, you know, go up to $2,000 or $3,000 in San Francisco, so a working musician, unless they're really damn famous, won't be able to afford that. And I'm seeing that with local musicians. It's like they got to move to Pflugerville or whatever, or Memphis.
Hey, I'm gonna ask us to shift gears for a sec, because I promised people that we would talk about rock and roll. It's been a great discussion.
You know what? I love rock and roll.
I know. I wanted to ask
that,
Jack.
That should be a song title.
You know, what's the greatest concert you've seen, Jack? I mean, you've seen a million of them, right?
You know, I already told you this is a very unfair question. It's like, what's your favorite band? I'm like,
we got 20 minutes.
God.
You could talk about several, you know?
I saw The Replacements in the late 80s in Hoboken, and I was just the right age. I was like a sort of a new wave. They call me a proto-punk in the 80s. Like, I like punk rock, but I also like The Cure, you know, like,
yeah.
It's kind of gothy, but also like, you know, and I saw The Replacements, and I was like, this is my generation's Who. This is the Who. This is insane. I mean, the unpredictability of, like, I wasn't old enough to not know that they were so shitter they couldn't play. It was just great. It was just great. I wouldn't say that's the best show, because I don't know, but they made such an impression on me that I probably listened to them, and I listen to a lot of music all week long. It's my job. I audition new stuff. I listen to old stuff. I listen to Replacements at least a couple times a week, just to kind of, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's kind of my number one. Was that the answer? I don't know.
That's a good answer. Yeah.
Yeah.
Is there a number two?
Oh man. no. There's a number 2 to 250.
I know it would be. I mean, it'd be hard for me. I've seen a ton of live bands over the years, and it's hard to just pick one. That Rolling Stones thing I mentioned earlier in 1981 at the Astrodome, with the Fabulous Thunderbirds and ZZ Top opening for them.
Yeah,
now, that was kind of a pinnacle right there. I haven't seen too many like that. But have you?
Robert Plant at ACL Live the first time, and I didn't know. A lot of times when you book someone who's a bit older, a lot of people just expect them to be great. Like, you're just grabbing it off the shelf and it's going to sound great. When you sing like that through like 5 decades, how do you still sing like that when you're that age? And I booked him, and of course it sold out because it's Robert Plant and everyone loves him. But I was a little nervous because I was like, what if he doesn't have it? He had his awesome band, and I didn't know. I didn't even cheat and look at the set list. I didn't even know what I was doing. And he came out, and I lost it. I was like, usually I stay in my little mezzanine safe place with my coworkers, and I'm like, going to the floor. I'm going to the floor to see Robert Plant. I need to be
nice.
Close. And he was absolutely incredible.
I saw him last time he was there, and when he launched into A Whole Lot of Love, oh my God,
a lot of people think it could be cheating. It's not.
Yeah, he hasn't changed a lot, because I saw early 70s and into the 80s. '70s because they went away, but saw a lot of Led Zeppelin and I went to all the Bill Graham massive arena concerts in Oakland, and they were the one that just everyone remembered. I mean, there were a lot of great shows there, but just being backstage and watching this guy perform is just mesmerizing. I mean, he was one of those performers that had complete control of the stage. I mean, you just had to watch him.
Powerful.
Yeah, he's amazing.
He very powerful. Even without Jimmy Page, I mean, you know what I mean? He commands a presence, and and when it comes out of his mouth and it's still amazing, then you're even like double goosebumps. You're like, oh my God.
So is there a concert at ACL that's an example of a great one, but that was just so transcendent that just you were like, wow, this is like I've been taken somewhere else by this experience.
At the venue now?
Yeah.
Well, okay, it's kind of cheating, but this band, so when I lived in Brooklyn, my neighbors were a band called The National. Everyone in Park Slope kind of lived semi-close to each other. Mm-hmm. And when I opened those two venues, I felt like every band in the world would just come hang out and drink, and they'd be like, what band are you in? I'm The National. I'm like, oh, that sounds funny. Like, I don't know who they are. And we became friends. And I remember when we opened the new place in Brooklyn, this is the coolest thing. They were already kind of big by then. And Bell House holds 400 people. And they said, hey, we'd really like to do like 3 nights as a record release party for this record we have, High Violet. And I was like, really? Like, I wasn't going to be the guy who asked them. I was like, you really want to? And they're like, yeah, we'd have to bring in all this stuff because basically your shit sucks, but bring in all of our own fancy stuff and we're going to play 3 nights here in our backyard. And I was like, way to make me look good. Fast forward, April 2014, I moved down here and C3 are like the big, big guys.
Mm-hmm.
And they put their stamp on everything. And as a booker, I had a really hard time with them at first, because every time I wanted to do something that I had already done, the agent was like, well, listen, man, we know that you're booking this cool place, but C3 have the history, so we're going to talk to them first. And I'd be like, great. And The National called and they said, hey, we want to do these 3 nights. Remember we did the 3 nights with you, you know, back at the Bell House? We want to do 3 nights at that new place. What are you doing? ACL Live? They're like, yeah, we want to do it there. And I was like, what? Well, what about the agent? And then I had to call the agent and I said, are you sure that they know what they're doing? Like, what are you going to do about C3? And they're like, we'll take care of C3. And my heart dropped and I was like, crazy. And the first night they played, like, Matt's in the bleacher. I mean, it was like the show that I hadn't seen yet, because I was so used to seeing them in a small place.
Oh,
he just taking his microphone, he's walking around. And I mean, I the combination of them doing that sort of for me as friends and then watching them, just, I didn't know where I was. I couldn't remember. I was crying. I was freaking out. Wow. And I'm like a grown up. What am I doing? This is insane. So anyway.
Well, speaking of multiple night gigs, didn't you have Neutral Milk Hotel for two nights at one time?
Two. Yeah. And then Courtney and I went to the comeback. Courtney was 8.5 months pregnant, and I made her go to Williamsburg to see Jeff in a loft space. After about, I guess they were probably already gone for 10, 15 years, but we got invited with 70 people in the loft space, and it was snowing, and Courtney was out to here with our kid. I was like, oh my God. I was like, we'll get in a cab. It'll be fine. And it was awesome. It was awesome. Epic.
Well, so what was the first show you remember seeing ever?
Beatlemania.
Really?
Wow. Came to my town when I was like eight. Isn't that weird?
Wow. I remember
somebody
that.
Was asking about, you know, like, asking, I think this was a Facebook thing, somebody asking about the first band you saw, and I had to think about it for a minute, but for me it was Spike Jones.
Oh wow.
Does that make me seem really old?
Yeah, but it's awesome.
I was like 5 years old or something. My parents took us to see Spike Jones in Abilene or somewhere like that.
I saw Roy Clark.
Wow.
Oh wow. That's great. He was one of the greatest guitarists ever.
I wish I'd seen that.
I'll go way back. My first was seeing Roy Orbison before he was signed. He did a local TV show out of Midland. And my sister dragged me to that. And it's like, just you know, a bunch of little kids, you know, in the studio. And they were just fantastic. They were just getting, you know, really, you know, tight. And it was shortly after that that... you know, they got signed to Sun Records and went away.
He was from somewhere up by Lubbock.
Wink, Texas.
Right. Yeah, Wink, Texas.
I spent a week in Wink one night.
Isn't that a song by like Hank Snow? Spent a week in Wink.
It's a song by anybody who's ever been to Wink.
My first show was the Kinks, and it was the original lineup of the Pretenders opening for them, and that's right when Chrissy and Ray were getting together. So there was all sorts of angst, and Dave was all mad, and it was.
Those were the good old days before she didn't sell her song to Rush Limbaugh. Why would she do that?
You guys have a lot of indie cred, but I said I was honest. Beatlemania. What?
I used to have a Beatlemania trash can.
Did you know Marshall Crenshaw ended up being in Beatlemania? I think I don't know if he was in it when I saw it. Probably not, because it was like 76 or something. But
yeah,
it would have been a good fit.
We've had Marshall Crenshaw at the venue twice. He's awesome.
He's amazing. What was the second show you saw?
Oh, I don't know. Cool in the Gang.
What was the first one? Okay.
Cool in the Gang.
If you notice, we have a lot of Cool in the Gang on the schedule once a year, and it's just like, it's my thing. It's New Jersey. I'm calling you guys. Come on, Cool in the Gang.
That's awesome.
Well, you know, it's really funny. We went to dinner at El Alma, which is kind of, you know, close to the kind of park area downtown. And we walked outside, and I heard this, "Celebrate Good Times," and it was Cool in the Gang, and they were playing like by at Town Lake.
Wow.
And we walked over and listened to them for a while.
Wow.
You know, they were still together, so they're still playing every year.
My thing with the legacy acts, like I said, like that, is it's called Cool in the Gang. Now a lot of singers are going to move on, a lot of band members are going to die, whatever's going to happen. As long as Cool is in the band, pop a cool bell, I will book them.
Okay.
Nice. They know what they know how to put on a show. They will replace people, whatever, but it's cool. So come back.
The gang. The gang. It's cool.
It's gang. What do you expect?
Yeah.
Is there a solo artist or a group that you wish you could book, whether they're around or they're not around? Like, you know, what's an ultimate one you'd love to book?
That's hard. No, that's impossible.
The Beatles.
I would say like Nick Drake or something.
Yeah, okay.
I did book Richard Thompson when I first moved here. I booked him at a place called the Belmont. We had a short agreement with those guys for like 2 years.
I remember that.
Mm-hmm, yeah,
they were like, Jack, that's your thing. And I'm like, okay. And I booked Richard Thompson in there, and he was so nice and so great.
Now, Lewis Karp down at Waterloo booked Richard Thompson one time, and they sold almost no tickets, and they had to move into a really small venue. And Lewis said, well, we're just having a very expensive private party here, basically. And he went, he showed up at Waterloo, and I got to meet him there. But I couldn't believe, how could you not sell out Richard Thompson? You know,
comes and
he probably
goes.
Had a sellout.
It comes and it comes and goes. It's just you never one man's legacy in 1 year. You don't know,
Yeah.
How is Steely Dan doing it without Walter Becker?
Donald Fagen wanted to do it. You want to carry on the legacy. All the shows are sold out, So,
I guess somebody can just learn the guitar licks, I guess.
Yeah, I don't know, but I was excited twice. It was supposed to be in December, then May, now probably like early 2021 if we're all alive.
So what is your if you have to pull up a song right now that you're listening to on your headphones, what is this song right now?
Oh, I was listening to Betty Wright because she just passed, and she had that song Clean Up Woman. She had a record out in 72. I've been going through a really I'm so white in my my Spotify lists come up and it's like Johnny Cash, The Replacements, Spoon. And I'm like, what the hell? And so I've been going through a really dark, deep dive of old school soul, but also in the beginning of the 80s. And I did not know this because I was listening to the Buzzcocks and stuff. There were so many great funk soul bands on major labels that never really became popular. And I'm deep diving on it, man.
Yeah, who?
Crazy, weird bands. One band was called Sunfire, which had this guy, Reggie Lucas, who ended up writing Madonna's first record. He wrote Everybody.
What?
Yeah, but he's a three-person soul band. And Mystic Merlin, they would, it's 1982, they dress up in weird wizard outfits. And it's just bom, 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 bom. I'm that's my deep dive right now. Every 6 months, I kind of move around. But Betty Wright, Clean Up Woman. That's my jam right now.
Excellent.
Did you ever bring Little Richard to ACL or anywhere else that you were?
No. My boss, Colleen, booked a place in Houston called Rockefeller's for 33 years. And she's the GM of the venue. She's amazing. I don't know if I could work for anybody else, right? Because she's great. And she was in Houston for 33 years, did Rockefeller's. She's booked B.B. King. She's booked everybody. A dozen times. That's her jam, I wish I had a chance to see Little Richard.
Yeah.
If not. Those early 70s records are so underrated. Mm-hmm. There's one called The Real Thing, R-I-L-L, The Real Thing.
I saw Little Richard somewhere. I can't even remember where. Maybe it was at the Armadillo, something like that.
Wow.
Really?
It's amazing who all played the Armadillo.
You guys are lucky with the Armadillo. That's all the stories I hear.
Mm-hmm. I paid $2 to see Bruce Springsteen at the Armadillo with Alvin Crow opening for him.
Oh, nice.
What a show. And it was an amazing show. This was when Bruce Springsteen was just starting to kind of break a little bit. Mm-hmm. And he was doing those really long shows,
Still,
I was supposed to meet a friend of mine was going to interview him backstage for the Daily Texan. And I couldn't find the guy. So I missed my chance to go backstage with him while he was doing that.
Mm-hmm.
But that was a great show. And we went back to see him again sometime later. And it was a little bit more expensive. But we took our son with us and put him up on the stage. This little kid on the stage sitting by the speakers. He's probably deaf from that.
My mother's convinced that she went on a date with Bruce Springsteen. They both went to Ocean County College in 1967 in Toms River, New Jersey. And I'm like, and she's holding on to this. I've never really I haven't really dug it out, but okay, Mom.
Hey, there's no reason not to keep that folklore going on.
You know, mm-hmm.
That's family stories. You got to hand that down. That's good stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Who's going to prove you wrong?
I didn't like Bruce Springsteen because it was Jersey. Like Bon Jovi and Springsteen were lost on me. But when I, you know, by the time I got about 30 and someone gave me Nebraska, I was like, what?
Mm-hmm. That's the one. That's the one.
This is
For me, it was The Wild, The Innocent, and The E Street Shuffle.
I love that now.
That Resolita song came on one day while I was standing on a ladder. I can still remember this. I think I was replacing a light bulb and that thing came on and I nearly fell off of the ladder. I was so excited. Oh, and I thought I was hearing Van Morrison. I actually thought it was Van Morrison until, you know.
Wow.
That's actually pretty good. That's because in the 70s, Van Morrison was like St. Dominic's. Mm-hmm. I can see that.
Yeah, it was close. Who you listened to lately that you really, really dig other than, I mean, you mentioned how about Yacht Rock? Are you still listening to Yacht Rock?
Well, that's a whole nother episode of your show that I want to bore you.
Yeah. We're up for it.
But I fight about Yacht Rock with everyone I know because in 2005, these guys in LA, they moved from Detroit, they're comedy writers, they came up with the word Yacht Rock. It's only 15 years old.
Yes.
They were kidding. They were goofing around. They made a whole internet TV series, 5-minute episodes. It's legend. It's legendary. We would host these Yacht Rock parties in New York where we would screen all the episodes. 400 people would come in sailor caps, everything. Epic parties. But there's a very, and you can listen to all the podcasts that are on out there beyond Yacht Rock, mm-hmm. explains it all. They are the four-man Supreme Court of what is Yacht Rock and what isn't. So some, you know, I told you, John, like I was at a party with you.
And yeah,
so
we were
to like America, Sistine Golden Hair, and like 100% not Yacht Rock.
Yeah.
No. And everyone's like, what are you talking about? I'm like, no, it's like soft rock from like the early 70s. Yacht Rock has a very specific
smooth
R&B jazz. Like Diana Ross has a Yacht Rock song. Dolly Parton has a Yacht Rock song. So there's a whole, if you go to Yacht or Nyacht, you can see how they rate them.
I feel like Lionel Richie must have at least one.
I think he does.
Lionel Richie is Yacht Rock.
Loggins. And Loggins and Michael McDonald, Steely Dan.
Oh, that's good stuff.
It's right there, though. But I spend my days on Twitter fighting with people because
that's awesome.
You know,
I'm going to follow you right now.
Some famous musician will say, like, this song's Yacht Rock. And I'll be like, bro, no. No, no.
That's excellent.
So you promised to come back and have that discussion, right?
Yeah.
We have to book a Yacht Rock special.
Yeah.
J.D. Riznar is the guy you need to get on the show. He's phenomenal.
Cool.
Hollywood Steve.
Thanks for joining us tonight. This
Thanks
is
for having
one
me.
Of the greatest episodes ever.
Yes. Thank you.
You'll come back.
Okay. Thanks for having me, you guys.
ACL Live has postponed most of its live events due to COVID-19. They're currently streaming video performances by popular artists, which may be viewed online or in person at 310 ACL Live. Learn more at acl-live.com. You can stay in touch with Plutopia at plutopia.io. On Facebook, look for @PlutopiaNews. On Twitter, it's @Plutopia. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.